Our web stream is made possible by donations from our listeners. Please go to WPKN.org to make a contribution or become a member of the WPKN community.
Well, that was music from 480 East from the CD entitled The Album and something called K-Town, dating back to 1997. Prior to that, you heard just a terrific song as the artist, the vocalist by the name of Steven Santoro, and I'll Be There. Whisper My Name is the name of the CD. It's on Red Lion Music. Steven Santoro. And we kick things off with that band from England called Incognito and a track entitled Pyramids from their Tribes, Vibes, and Scribes release. That's the show. Just before I leave you, here's the latest from the National Weather Service. Tonight, mostly cloudy, lows in the upper 40s. Tuesday, cloudy, highs in the low 60s. Tuesday night, cloudy, a slight chance of light rain after midnight with lows in the mid-40s. Veterans Day looks like this, mostly cloudy with a chance of light rain in the morning, then partly sunny with a slight chance of light rain in the afternoon with highs in the lower 50s. Wednesday night, mostly clear, lows in the mid-30s. Thursday looks like this, sunny with highs in the mid-50s. Thursday night, mostly clear with lows in the upper 30s. And Friday, to round out the week, sunny, highs in the mid-50s. And if you're heading out Friday night, partly cloudy, lows in the lower 40s. That's the way it happened on this edition of Jazz Variations. You are tuned to 89.5 FM WPKN Bridgeport and 88.7 FM WPKM Montauk. My name's Patrick O'Sullivan. I'll see you again next week. Scott Harris is up. So, stay tuned. Lots for you to chew on. Bye-bye.
Welcome to this week's edition of the White Rose Political Calendar. The calendar takes its name from the White Rose, a resistance group in Nazi Germany that worked to educate and organize opposition to the Welcome to this week's edition of the White Rose Political Calendar. The calendar takes its name from the White Rose, a resistance group in Nazi Germany that worked to educate and organize opposition to the Welcome to this week's edition of the White Rose Political Calendar. The calendar takes its name from the White Rose, a resistance group in Nazi Germany that worked to educate and organize opposition to the
Apologies for this CD. We're going to play last week's White Rose because we're having some trouble with this week's audio. But there's some information here that's still relevant, so stay tuned.
Welcome to this week's edition of the White Rose Political Calendar. The calendar takes its name from the White Rose, a resistance group in Nazi Germany that worked to educate and organize opposition to the horrifying agenda of the Third Reich. In the spirit of the White Rose, WPKN offers its weekly political calendar in order to give voice to the struggle for political, social, economic, and environmental justice. Here are this week's listings. Starting Tuesday, October 27th, and running through February 5th, 2010, the Arts Council of Greater New Haven presents Out of House and Home, an exhibition that explores the comforts and securities of home and the uncertainties and anxieties brought to bear by the recent mortgage crisis, record foreclosures, and plummeting real estate values. The exhibition will be on display at the Parachute Factory, Erector's Square, 319 Peck Street, Building 1 in New Haven. An artist reception is scheduled for Tuesday, October 27th from 5 to 7 p.m. The reception and the exhibit are free and open to the public. The works of participating artists range from the comforts of home to the struggle for survival in the most primitive of shelters. This exhibit is a collaboration with Columbus House Homeless Shelter. On Thursday, October 29th at 7 p.m., Ralph Nader will speak at Labyrinth Books, 290 York Street in New Haven, about his new work of fiction, Only the Super Rich Can Save Us. He'll address the looming economic and environmental crises and what should be done. This extraordinary story, written by the author who knows the most about citizen action, returns us to the literature of American social movements, to Edward Bellamy, to Upton Sinclair, to John Steinbeck, and Stephen Crane, reminding us in the process that changing the body politic of America starts with imagination. The event is free and open to the public. For more information, write to info-nh@labyrinthbooks.com or call 203-787-2848. That's 203-787-2848. Also on Thursday, October 29th at 7 p.m., it's the Oxford Land Trust annual meeting and program at Oxford Town Hall, 486 Oxford Road. After a brief business meeting, Master Wildlife Conservationist Felicia Ortner will present a talk entitled Black Bears in Connecticut. This program is free and open to the public. For more information, call Peter Petrochko at 203-888-9835. That's 203-888-9835, or email ppetrochko, that's P-P-E-T-R-O-C-H-K-O, at earthlink.net. On Friday, October 30th, join the Critical Mass Halloween bike ride. Cyclists meet at the flagpole on New Haven's Lower Green at 5:30 p.m. with a 6 p.m. departure. Costumes are highly encouraged. Make sure your vision is not obstructed and that no flowing garments will create an Isadora Duncan demise. New Haven's Kinder, Gentler Critical Mass is free and aims to create a sense of fun and community among area cyclists. On Saturdays through November 21st, from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., It's Open Farm Day, sponsored by Common Ground. 358 Springside Avenue on the flank of West Rock Ridge in New Haven. Take a self-guided tour of our beautiful urban organic farm at the peak of fall harvest season. Sample herbs in the garden, see the ripening fall harvest, and visit the farm animals. Free for all ages. For more information, contact Rebecca Holcomb at 203-389-4333, extension 1213. Or email rholcomb, R-H-O-L-C-O-M-B-E, at nhep.com. Looking ahead a bit, on Thursday, November 5th at 7 p.m., the 4th Annual East End Black Film Festival will screen Beyond the Bricks at the Parish Art Museum, 25 Jobs Lane, Southampton, New York. The short documentary focuses on the alarming dropout rate of African-American male students in America's public schools. It explores the issues that produce these dismal statistics, but focuses on the solutions to the poor academic performance and low graduation rates of school-age black males in the U.S. The film will be followed by a focused Q&A, audience discussion, with the producer and director of the film, as well as Southampton High School principal Adam Fine and teachers and parent advocates. The event is free and open to the public, but seating is limited. RSVP by emailing all guest names to Bonnie M. Cannon at gmail.com. That's BonnieMcannon at gmail.com. For more information, call 631-766-8642. 631-766-8642. To include your group's upcoming events in the listings of the White Rose Political Calendar, send information about national, regional, and local events 2 weeks in advance when possible to whiterosewpkn at gmail.com. That's whiterosewpkn at gmail.com. This week's calendar was produced by Melinda Tubus.
Sorry about the problems we had, little technical problems with the White Rose calendar this week. This is WPKN in Bridgeport and WPKM in Montauk. Stay tuned next for Counterpoint.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake. Birds and snakes and airplane. Lenny Bruce is not afraid. I have a hurricane. Listen to yourself. Turn world to its own needs. Dummy, serve your own needs. Beat it up a notch. Speak front. No stream. Done that. Start to clatter with fear. Fight down. High wire and a fire. Represented seven games in a government for hire and a combat site. Net to us are coming in a hurry with the fury screaming down. Your my team reporters babble Trump, dead and crap. Look at that, no plane, fine, then, uh-oh, overflow, population common, do what it'll do, save yourself, serve yourself, world, serve your own needs, listen to your heart, breathe, dummy with the rapture and the reverend and the right, right, you patriotic, patriotic, slam, fight, bright, high feeling, pretty sight,
it's the end of the world as we know it, it's the end of the world as we know it, it's the end of the world. Slice and burn, return, listen to yourself, churn. Locking in, uniform and book, burning blood, red in every motive, escalate, automotive, centering. Light a candle, light a motive, step down, watching heel, crush, crush, uh-oh, this means no fear. Cavalier, renegade, steer clear, a tournament of lies. Offer me solutions, offer me alternatives, and I decline. It's the end of the world as we know it.
Good evening and welcome to Counterpoint. My name is Scott Harris here on this station every Monday between 8 and 10 p.m. bringing you voices of dissent from the perspectives not ordinarily seen and heard and read in mainstream corporate media. Tonight, in just a moment, we're going to be speaking with Donna Smith, community organizer and legislative advocate with the California Nurses Association. And we're going to be looking at the House healthcare reform legislation that just passed Saturday night and the critique of it from the perspective of another single-payer advocate. A little later tonight, we're going to be hearing from Carl Frisch, senior fellow with the Media Watch Group Media Matters for America, and we're going to be looking at the corporate media spin on the results of the local and state elections this past Tuesday. And there's a lot of spin there to take track of or to take stock of. And lastly, tonight, Joe Dinkin, Communications Director with the Working Families Party of Connecticut, will be with us to also look at the local perspective on progressive gains and losses in Connecticut's November 3rd municipal elections, which the Working Families Party took part. But right now, I want to welcome to our program Donna Smith. Again, she's a community organizer and legislative advocate with the California Nurses Association. She was featured in Michael Moore's documentary film Sicko, and she's produced a follow-up film titled American Sickos, looking at how proposed health care reform legislation would affect the provision of medical insurance to those individuals featured in that documentary movie about the desperate need for health care reform in the United States. Donna Smith, thanks so much for being here with us tonight.
Of course. Thank you for having me on.
So we were, of course, treated to a lot of pomp and circumstance around the 11:30 at night vote this past Saturday in the House passage of health care reform bill that now must be reconciled with whatever the Senate comes up with, if it actually passes the Senate. And I guess before we get started on some of the work that you've been doing to raise some important issues around the direction of the health care reform that you're not so happy with, why don't you give us your overall assessment of what the House passed Saturday night? What's your critique of it?
Wow. Well, after watching it for several torturous hours on C-SPAN, as I'm sure many people did, to see exactly what the pomp and circumstance would look like, My fear is that we've passed something that, first of all, will not really improve the situation for access to health care for so very many people who need it desperately. We've certainly, if the House version of health reform legislation were to be ultimately enacted into law, certainly we'd have purchase mandates so that all of us would have to purchase private insurance if it was not offered through our employers, and we'd have to purchase it out through the exchange set up by the federal government, and a lot of citizens in New England and Massachusetts certainly would be familiar with that kind of a purchasing scenario. There are some limited things about the bill that could be helpful to some people who have not been able to get insurance in the past. For instance, the much-touted removing pre-existing condition clauses and forbidding insurance companies from rescinding your policy simply because you get sick. Those things might have some limited benefit to people who have not been able to get coverage. But obviously the concern for those of us who have been watching this legislation closely is that by creating 47 million more customers for the health insurance industry and massive gains for them in terms of revenue, it does nothing to alleviate the situation of denial of treatment when an insurance company feels like a treatment's too expensive or is not what would be in line with their bottom line. They can certainly still deny that treatment. There's nothing in the legislation that will prevent them from doing that. And also a big concern about the, obviously today we're hearing some follow-up to it, but big concern about the STUPAC amendment that passed. The limits on abortion funding that went well beyond what's already in place in federal legislation, and that's of grave concern to not only lots of women's groups around the country, but just lots of Americans in general who feel like this bill did a lot of things that hurt a lot of people, and we're not sure exactly in the long run whether it's really helping control costs or doing anything that we really had to set out to do to create health care as a basic human right.
Donna, tell us a bit about your own personal story, because you were featured in Michael Moore's documentary, a very powerful documentary that contrasted the failed U.S. healthcare system, you know, that left or that leaves out millions, you know, 47 million or so Americans from any kind of coverage at all, and comparing it with much of the rest of the industrialized world that has single-payer health care for all their citizens. But remind our listeners who maybe saw the movie or maybe didn't see it about your own particular situation that was profiled in the movie.
Sure. We were among about 12 odd separate families that were profiled in the film. And our story basically was the story of millions of American families. Both my husband and I have worked all of our lives and always purchased insurance through our employers. and every year would make an analysis of what which policy worked best for our family and so forth. And as long as we were well, we could kind of deal with the drift in terms of premiums going up like we've all seen them going up over the last 20 years, and the co-pays and deductibles starting to rise and different things being a little bit more stressful for our budget. When you're well, we could deal with that and absorb it. But as the years went on and the premiums crept up and up, I then purchased a disability insurance policy through my employer, and I had a little health care savings account, not much. But I was doing everything I thought I had to do to protect us from financial ruin should one of us get sick. But my husband had a lot of serious, still does, has a lot of serious artery disease issues in his heart and peripheral artery disease. And I, unfortunately, was diagnosed with uterine cancer. And between those two things and the maximum out-of-pocket exposure that was allowable under our private health insurance plan, we were wiped out financially in a very short amount of time. We lost, we first sold our home and netted out not very much money at that point because we had to sell it and we used what we could to live on and pay bills. And ultimately, the illness didn't know that we needed to stop losing money, and we continued to struggle and ended up declaring bankruptcy and having to move into our daughter's basement. And we were one of the first stories told in the movie. So Michael Moore's folks were kind of chronicling what happened to us. And I often tell people it's not because we were so unique that Michael Moore featured us in the film. It's because we were not unique, because we represented so many millions of working families in this country who are doing what they believe is right, doing what they're supposed to do, buying insurance and keeping themselves protected, and then finding out when they get sick, they are not protected financially, and that financial ruin can happen in a matter of months.
I hope to take some listener calls later, Donna, and also maybe play a segment of your the film that you put together following up on some of the families and individuals profiled in Michael Moore's movie, the American Sickos film. But tell our listeners how this health care legislation that just passed the House, how would that have affected your situation? Would you have gone into bankruptcy and been subjected to all this incredibly financial and emotional hardship had that legislation been in place when you and your husband were dealing with these health issues?
Unfortunately, it's entirely possible, and let me explain how. One of the most frustrating things for me in the last several weeks when I've been listening to this discussion about the reform in Washington is hearing our legislators say no longer will someone in the United States go broke because they get sick. That is just not true. So many of us who go out and purchase insurance, oftentimes we have to take or we can't buy it on the private market for the most part. The cost is too prohibitive. So we buy through our employers whatever our employers offer, and that was the case for us. That will still be the case for many millions of Americans. You will buy what your employer is able to offer, and oftentimes for an employer, the most economical plan they can offer is one that is going to have high copays, high deductibles, high cost sharing on the part of the patient or the policyholder. That will still be available, and in large part it will be available to those employers that aren't huge employers with lots of bargaining power in terms of bringing a very large risk pool to an insurer. They're still going to have millions and millions and millions of us who have to buy those kinds of policies that leave us very exposed financially. You know, you'll hear of a $2,000 or $3,000 deductible for the year and a maximum out-of-pocket exposure like my husband and I had of $9,000 or $10,000 in a year. And you don't think about that until you're sick, how quickly that can mount up and be a very high debt. That will still be allowable. Just because you have to purchase a insurance policy does not mean that everybody is going to purchase an insurance policy that will keep them protected. I heard one of our congressional representatives say to me one time, well, nobody will be able to have more than $11,000 or $12,000 a year in medical debt. That'll keep people from going bankrupt. And I asked her, I said, how do you think that's true? Tell me how you think having $11,000 or $12,000 in medical debt in a year will prevent you from being bankrupt. And she was dumbfounded. She said, it won't? I said, no. A hospital can go after you for whatever amount of money is still owed to them. A doctor can, a provider can. They want to collect their money. They will still go after you in whatever way they need to do. And families can be driven into bankruptcy by much lesser amounts than most people think. Folks often think of bankruptcy as being driven by hundreds of thousands of dollars. Not true. For my husband and I, it wasn't very much money at all that ultimately tipped the scale over into bankruptcy. We were at the point of my wages were going to be garnished if I didn't declare bankruptcy. And if my wages had been garnished, I wouldn't have been able to pay all the insurance premiums and the out-of-pocket costs to keep us alive. That whole scenario will still be able to unfold under this legislation. That's what very much concerns me.
What about the public option? That's certainly been, for better or for worse, that's been the focus of a lot of the debate in the country and on Capitol Hill about where this health care reform legislation is going to go. The weekend public option put forward by Nancy Pelosi and the House Democrats, as you said, it's not going to be available to most people in this country. I think only 2 or 3% of the population of the nation will be eligible to get it. And from what I understand, the Congressional Budget Office estimated it, the premiums for the public option that they were talking about may be even more expensive than private, similar health insurance policies.
Exactly.
So this seems to be a lose-lose situation if you look at just the outlines of what we know today. Things could change, but it doesn't look all that great.
No, it doesn't look great. And, you know, and this was always the position of the Nurses Association, the California Nurses Association, was that the congressional members started out with their weakest bargaining position instead of starting out with their strongest bargaining. The strongest and best way to solve the health care problem we have in this country is to go with a single-payer plan, which, by the way, does not mean the whole means of control of the delivery of the health care system rests with the government. Now, personally, for me, that'd be okay with me. I think the VA system operates very well, and that is a single-payer system in this country. Medicare is also a single-payer system, but it's a little bit different with Medicare. So many of your listeners, I'm sure, will be familiar with Medicare. Many are probably on it. That everybody pays in a Medicare premium, and they go to the doctor and provider of their choice, and those bills are paid by the government. The government acts as the policyholder. Well, you know, interestingly, the public plan was supposed to be this robust plan, and we heard the words, "Oh my God!" all summer long. They became so discouraged by the language usage. You know, we'd hear robust, and then we'd hear strong. It's got to be a very strong public option. And what we ultimately ended up with was something very in a very weakened state that only, as you say, the Congressional Budget Office estimates less than 2% of Americans under 65 will even be able to purchase the public option. And because the insurance companies didn't really want there to be any competition, and they really were very much in control of making sure the legislation looked like they wanted it to look, the public option isn't going to be able to provide that offsetting competition. Even if that were a possibility, it isn't going to be able to do that because of the way the legislation ultimately came down. So I think it's a great disappointment to a large number of people. And now we're in a situation where the House bill is everyone's looking at it thinking that's going to be probably the most liberal effort that comes out of Congress. When we jump over to the Senate side, we're going to get something that's going to look even weaker in terms of what's available for people. So it's a very frightening situation, I think. It could, as I heard Congressman Massa say over the weekend, and he voted against the legislation primarily because he felt it would more deeply entrench the interests of the private insurance industry and give them greater control over what's happening in our healthcare system than already is, and does nothing to get a handle on the cost, the rising cost in the system.
Donna Smith is our guest, a community organizer and legislative advocate with the California Nurses Association Union. And Donna's story and her husband's was featured in Michael Moore's documentary film about the health care failure in our country, that film called Sicko. And Donna, there are many who support the House of Representatives bill and looking to some compromise, final legislation that Barack Obama can sign into law. And they admonish us to not let the perfect be the enemy of the good, that incrementalism is probably the only way we pragmatically can get health care reform in this country. So we shouldn't throw out this effort, even though it's not perfect. How do you respond to that?
Well, you know, I can certainly understand that position. A lot of really good and dear people to me share that vision. And what I'm really looking for and have been looking for and wanted to look for in, from this Congress was efforts that moved us in the right direction. You know, if we couldn't get there all at once, let's get there moving in the right direction. And my problem now when I take a look at the legislation is I feel like there's the gaping holes that they left are those that are going to hurt families and working people the most. And that's what really worries me. We didn't move in the right direction. And that's troubling, very troubling to me. And, you know, I understand the issues that, that people put. They're very afraid. Some people who like the, who, there are some people, and I've heard from them too, who say they like the coverage they've got, although those tend to be my friends and family and neighbors who haven't really had to test their health care insurance situation. They've not had, fortunately for them, thank God, a serious illness where they've really had to work on it. So I think that my concern, and I think the nurses have a concern, that while we've taken some limited improvement, for instance, expanding Medicaid coverage to cover more people who are in different groups is a good thing. That's a good thing, and that is in this legislation. That in itself is a good thing, but there are so many things that are troubling in the legislation that they tend to offset that. So we weren't anxious. We, as nurses, nurses are never anxious to have anything that will move healthcare reform in the right direction be viewed in anything but a great light. This is problematic for us. This legislation does not give us the direction that we need in moving towards healthcare justice for every single American.
Donna Smith, if you had a vote in Congress right now, would you vote for this, what we know, the bill that emerged in the House, passed in the House, and the likely weakening of it with any kind of Senate-House compromise, do you think you would go for it despite all the flaws, or would you like to see this go down to defeat and start again from scratch at a future date?
Wow, that's a loaded question. Well, on the vote over the weekend with the House, I would have had to vote no on it just on the abortion amendment issue alone. Not because I'm necessarily, you know, I'm certainly not somebody who thinks that abortion is the way to go if you've got other options. And I think most women certainly don't choose abortion choose it lightly or move in that direction lightly. But that, attaching that amendment to it so subverted the process, I felt, of getting that legislation in the right direction. I would have voted no on that. That's just me personally. I would have voted no on that legislation. I think I'm going to have to wait and see what happens out of this Senate. You know, I tell people I'm the eternal optimist that something decent can come out of something that, that maybe doesn't look so in the beginning. I tell people if a year and a half ago someone had asked us, would we be bailing out Wall Street to the tunes of many trillions of dollars, we all would have said, no way, there's no way our Congress would do that or our president would do that. And yet we did do that. And I also tell people in a, perhaps a more positive light, if we had all looked about a year and a half ago again and asked in a race between Barack Obama and John McCain for president of the United States, who would win? And if we had polled people a year and a half ago, Barack Obama would win Illinois and Hawaii. That's it. So things can change. Things can happen. Lights can go on. Even legislators can look at an effort and say, wait a minute, that isn't the direction we need to go in. I'm hopeful that with enough pressure, Bernie Sanders is going to offer some really good amendments in the Senate. There's some very thoughtful legislators on that side. I'm hopeful that the Senate can actually take a look at this and instead of giving us something weaker, perhaps give us something more intelligent, something that does move us in the direction we need to go for more people in this country.
As you've talked about in other venues, it seems that the biggest effort here was to protect the profit margins of the big insurance companies in the country, and the legislators are concerned about that primarily because they benefit from a lot of those profits as that cash flows into their campaign funds, their reelection campaign funds. So we have a system that's extremely flawed, well beyond just our health care system. We've got a campaign finance system that breeds this kind of corruption where a lot of senators and congresspeople are bought off by the hundreds of millions of dollars flowing into the campaign coffers of our so-called representatives. That's what really, I think, has to be changed if we're going to make progress on health care and a whole bunch of other issues.
No, absolutely. I'll quickly say I met with a member of the Senate Finance Committee some months ago, Senator Baucus's committee, and he shared with me, he said that the senators have a visceral reaction to single payer. And I let him speak for a minute, and then I said, what do you mean a visceral reaction? What do you mean by that? And he said, well, because elections are reality, and elections cost a lot of money. And in order to put to be successfully reelected, it takes a lot of money to do that. And it's just flat reality. So you couldn't be more right on talking about the campaign finance reform in terms of that driving even good and decent people in our Congress, and there are many, who really went to Congress believing that they wanted to make a difference and do a good thing. But once they get there, they are subverted by this ever-increasing need to raise more and more money to run more and more expensive campaigns, and that unfortunately drives so many of their decisions that it's really subverting all of what we try and do.
Donna, just a last question for you. I know the California Nurses Association and other coalition allies have launched a series of protests and civil disobedience actions around the country to point up the flaws and failures of some of the legislative direction of this health care reform effort. Tell our listeners a bit about that.
Well, there's a number of organizations that have come together to say that they just have to stand up and say that going to an expanded and improved Medicare for All type plan is the right direction for this nation to go. There are a number of groups working together on a program called Mobilization for Healthcare for All that people can go to the web and look at that site, where there have been some brave people sitting in insurance companies and trying to say that they want the profits to stop. They want insurance companies to stop putting money into lobbying and leave that money in patient care and approving medical treatment. So folks can check out websites for Mobilization for Healthcare for All, or Healthcare Now is another good site to look at. Progressive Democrats of America have been participating. Physicians for a National Health Program have had a number of their physicians involved in these protests, and people have gone to congressional offices and done sit-ins. It's been quite an active time, and if you'd listen, I know I was listening to you talk about what's going to be on your show a little bit later. You're going to talk more about fairness and media coverage, and if you'd listened to the media coverage over the summer, you'd think that the teabaggers and that whole right-wing effort was all that was going on with the health care discussion. Certainly not true. There's an awful lot of Americans out there weighing in very heavily and very clearly on their preference that we move to a different kind of system in this country, less profit-driven and more people-driven, and that's happening all over the country. And I'm so appreciative of those programs like yours that are actually giving voice to what's happening out there, because it isn't just the teabaggers. That's a small portion of what the voice is that's being amplified by the mainstream media in a way that's making it very troubling.
Yeah, I certainly will echo those sentiments. It's a wasteland out there in large part. There are some islands of sanity, but it's pretty scary when you listen to characters like Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck that have such an enormous audience and influence, of course, millions of people as to how they see the world in a very warped and strange way, dangerous way, as you said, Donna. Hey, as we say goodbye here, what would you suggest our listeners do? I know a lot of people are very frustrated with this process of compromise and sellout, as many of us see it. But what would you encourage people to do at this moment when so much is at stake in terms of where health care legislation will wind up?
I think weighing in with your senators is one of the most important things you can do. As frustrating as it may be to think that sometimes voices aren't heard, I have been in offices in Washington many, many times in the last few months where staff members were taking calls from constituents, and it really does matter when they hear from their constituents saying that there's an expectation that that senator or that person operate in a way that's consistent with the people's needs. You need to do that. You also, if you can and you're able to, get involved in some of the advocacy that's going on in your community, whether it's going to a congressional office, whether it's going and writing a letter to the editor of your local newspaper, whether it's blogging on your favorite blog, wherever it might be, spreading the word is extremely important. We still have to talk to one another. I've now been in 43 states in the District of Columbia talking about health care reform. And I tell people all the time, it's not the people of the country that are really the problem. Once we talk to each other and we say we're all experiencing the same thing, crushing costs in our families, trying to keep ourselves insured, or if we're not insured, fear about how we're going to take care of someone if they get sick or ourselves, We all understand that, and we know that it's not right. We know that at our core. So if we talk to each other about how we can best fix that for ourselves and for the future of the country, we get it. And that's what we have to do a whole lot more of, and then communicate that very clearly to our elected officials, that our expectation is that they will behave in a way that's consistent with what we want. We are the ones paying their salaries. We are the ones providing them with benefits. We are the ones making sure that they have what they need in order to serve us. So it's perfectly consistent for us to stay clear and loud and be heard from very frequently with them.
Well said. Tana, thanks so much for being here. And you can sort of just give out some of these websites again. I know healthcarenow.org is one of them, right?
Yep, healthcare-now. I know it's hard sometimes for people to figure, but it's healthcare-now.org, pdamerica.org, pnhp.org, guaranteedhealthcare.org is the California Nurses site where we keep a lot of information, and where listeners can also go tell their own personal stories. And I actually am the one who goes on that website and reads every one of those stories that comes in. So,
wow. What was that one again?
It's guaranteedhealthcare.org, all one word, guaranteedhealthcare.org. And we try and keep the most up-to-date information there. And people can also tell us their stories. And whenever possible, we will try and use, if you give us permission to, we'll try and use that story in a way that helps get the word across that we to nurses and patients together have a story to tell that can help change this nation. So please come on with us and tell your story and let's work together to get some change done.
So that's guaranteedhealthcare.org and then mobilization for healthcare for all. Right?
Sorry. Yeah.
Mobilization for Healthcare for All.org.
Yeah.
And that those are the groups and coalition that are working on some of these civil disobedience actions at various offices of insurance companies around the country, right?
Yep.
Okay. Well, Donna, thanks again for being here and all your really hard work on these issues that affect, as you say so rightly, affect all of us or will affect us all as our health will start failing. And we're going to need this kind of service without the awful prospect of going bankrupt and losing everything, which is unfortunately what you're saying. This legislation that passed the House will not prevent in most cases, so that's sad and scary. So maybe we can do something to change it, as you said, to get active is probably the only way to go here.
I agree.
All right, Donna, thanks again for being here.
Thank you so much.
Good night.
Good night.
Donna Smith, community organizer and legislative advocate with the California Nurses Association Union. Again, go to their website, guaranteedhealthcare.org, and mobilization for healthcare for all.org. And those are a couple of places, among others, that you can go to find out what people are doing to advocate for a more comprehensive solution to our healthcare disaster. And going well beyond what the House passed this past Saturday night. And we have some time here. One of our guests became ill, I found out earlier tonight, Dar Jamel, unfortunately. But it gives us some time to get your phone calls on what you're thinking about this health care reform legislation that passed the House on Saturday with a STUPAC amendment restricting funds for abortion and all the rest of it. We invite your calls. We got a little while here before our next guest comes up at the top of the hour at 9 p.m., but do call us at 203-336-9756. I know there are probably a lot of varied opinions on there about how this was historic and a breakthrough, and we got to take what we can get at this point versus wanting the perfect bill. A lot of that and a lot of in-between views and mixed feelings, I'm sure. But do call us at 203-336-9756 so we can hear your thoughts, share them with the audience. And we're also going to get to a little bit of the film that Donna Smith actually gave us or produced recently about the problem. About the problems still facing many of these folks profiled in Michael Moore's movie Sicko that will not be addressed in some of this legislation. So let's go to the phones. Hello, WPKN, you're on the air.
Hey, Scott.
Hey.
This is Richard from New Canaan.
Hey, Richard, thanks for calling.
Yeah, I just want to compliment you on and compliment Donna Smith for appearing on the program tonight. you know, I think she really said it like it is. And I would have only, if I'd had an opportunity, asked her what her take was on why Congressman from New York, Anthony Weiner, withdrew his amendment to vote on single payer, you know, that he had been promised by Congressman Pelosi.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm sorry you didn't get to ask that question. I would only say that with the vote being so close, with 2 or 3 vote margin, it was amazingly close in the House.
Yeah.
I imagine Nancy Pelosi, as Speaker of the House, leaned pretty heavily on everybody to come together on something, or they wouldn't pass anything. Although, you're right, it was just maybe symbolic at that point to get it discussed on the House floor. You know, I'm just guessing, but
yeah, yeah. And then I'd say the other thing is that with regard to the single payer, she did mention, you know, the disastrous amendment that was put forth by the congressman from Michigan, that it became part of the House bill.
The Stupak amendment.
The Stupak
amendment. On abortion. Yeah.
Yeah. But she didn't mention that. Congressman Kucinich had a amendment to allow states' rights to individually decide whether they would like to enact their own single payer health care program, and that was withdrawn from the legislation. It had passed like a few committees, and apparently that can come back in the final bill.
Yeah, well, I hope it does, because we've talked about this on the show many times. In Canada, they got their single-payer universal health care system there, up in that nation, when Saskatchewan launched their own provincial-wide, like a statewide, single-payer health care system. And it was so successful, and, you know, people liked it so much, it was adopted federally by the entire nation of Canada.
Yeah.
And maybe, you know, we're hoping that if the states were able to experiment, like you said, with the Kucinich Amendment, it could spell a bright future for going a single payer. But, you know, it's a sad day when, you know, even that was taken off the table. So many compromises were made here.
Exactly.
Well, we got some other callers, but anything you want to close with, or you're all set?
I think I'm good.
All right. Thanks for calling. Appreciate
Bye-bye.
It. Bye. Hi, Pecan, you're on the air.
Yes, I wanted to know concerning the insurance that they're saying that's going to affect the elderly. I just wanted to know if you could be a little clear of how that, to me, the laws that they're passing with the insurance, I think it's going to end up hurting our parents that are retired, and that has me a little concerned.
In what way do you specifically have a concern about how that would affect retirees and all?
Yes, because of course they have the Medicare, and they have, like, for short-term insurance when they retire. But the medications alone, when you have an elderly person that is sick, I get very frustrated, because we have our parents here that worked all our life, and they have to pay an arm and a leg to get their medicine. And then you have, you know, this out in Canada that people are getting the same medication for $2 or $3.
Well, you know why that was. I know George W. Bush pushed the Medicare Part D, and if I'm speaking incorrectly, I know one of the listeners will correct me. But when that was passed by the Republican-controlled Congress, mm-hmm. and George Bush, who was pushing for it, that Part D in the Medicare allowed, you know, incorporation of purchase of pharmaceutical drugs, right?
Mm-hmm.
We know that. But what one essential part that was deliberately not part of that legislation was the ability of the federal government under Medicare to negotiate prices with a big pharmaceutical company. In other words, using the enormous pool and purchasing power of all those millions of people across the country who would get drugs, to use that purchasing power, as Canada does, as you rightly say, to reduce the price with you know, demanding huge discounts from these big companies because you're buying millions of doses or hundreds of millions of doses or this or that drug. So that could be fixed. And I'm not sure the status of efforts to fix that, but if the country did fix that under Medicare Part D, it would reduce the price of medications.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't have the answer, but I know that was a huge flaw in that Medicare Part D situation.
It's very frustrating when you hear how people are quick to judge that President Obama is not doing enough or he's making it worse. And he did arrive there with the problem, and he's been trying his best to, you know, to help this. I mean, Kennedy was someone that fought so much for that. And it's something that when you have people that have no insurance at all, that does end up putting a burden on everybody.
Oops.
Because sometimes they'll go to work and they're ill. They don't go at all. They end up in an emergency room when they're sick because they have no insurance at all. And it's just, that's something that, you know, he's trying to do, but you always have people that want to, it almost is like they want to shoot down everything he says, when, to me, I think he's trying to do his very best with the mess that they left on his lap when Bush left. So.
Well, I can hardly hear you. I've got some problem here with my my board, but I'm going to just say goodnight, because I'm going to try and fix something that's wrong on my board. But I appreciate all your comments.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. And thank you for taking my call.
Okay. Thank you very much. Hello, WPKN. You're on the air.
Hey, Scott. This is Blair.
Hey, Blair. How are you doing?
Good. Are you sure you're still on the air? Because you went off the air on my radio, but
yeah, no, it's entirely possible that we went off the air, and I don't really know what's happened here.
All of a sudden, it just got, there was like a lot of static, and there was no signal.
All right. Well, we're going to have to get this figured out. I'm just seeing the view meters on here, and I guess... oh, man. Yeah. I am hearing exactly what you're hearing.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't think you're broadcasting.
That's great. What a wonderful night this has been.
I had a point to make, but
yeah.
Now it's useless.
Well, let me see if I can reboot this thing. I don't know what happened to it. All right. So
should I hang on or not?
Yeah, hang on. Let's see what happens. Well, we're back on the air. Apparently, we popped off the air momentarily. Don't ask me why or how or what happened. I don't know. Must have been the health insurance companies after us again. Anyway, I've got a caller on the line, so let's continue where we left off. And I'm sorry that we lost our transmitter momentarily, but the good thing is we're back, and I've got Blair on the line who wants to make a comment on our discussion on what passed the House last night, Saturday night. By way of healthcare legislation. Blair, you're up.
Well, I certainly share the disappointment of your guest about what we're probably eventually going to get out of the Congress, assuming that something gets through the Senate. It's certainly not, you know, anything that I think is any terrific reform, although it does carry a few few positive aspects if what they pass in the House basically makes it through the Senate. But there's also a larger issue here that I think a lot of people are forgetting about, which is the right wing has stated very clearly that they want to make this issue sort of, I think as one of the congressmen put it, you know, Obama's Waterloo or something to that effect. And there are a lot of other things that many of us would like to get through Congress. And if this fails, even if this very flawed bill fails, I think we're going to see an even more rejuvenated right wing in this country, which will make it that much more difficult to pass other progressive legislation. So I think that is a factor in whether we want to see, you know, what comes out and get passed or not, although it'll probably be a great disappointment to many of us on the in the sort of progressive wing of politics. I mean, being a labor leader, I mean, one of the most important things we want to get through is the Employee Free Choice Act, and it's not going to even be considered until we get through this debate. And if sort of Obama loses and nothing gets passed, it's going to make it even more difficult to get legislation like that. So I think that is one of the reasons I think that, you know, may have to all hold our noses and say, okay, we got something, it's nothing what we want, we know it's not real health care reform, and, you know, push on from there. I think it is also important that we do try to get the ability to states to do their own reforms and have their own single payer. That, I think, if we could get that in, that would make almost any bill worth it.
Yeah, so. No, I agree. We might have to take the long-term view, as you said. But in the short term, yes, a failure here, even if it's for the reasons of principle and, you know, moral opposition and outrage that this bill isn't better, you're right. The symbolism will be to the benefit of the extreme right that will claim a victory and try and neuter President Obama and any good that he could do in his first term in office and use the failure on health care as a rallying cry to, to certainly critique his ability to get anything done.
Right.
So I don't know. It's a conundrum to want a better outcome here with health care reform legislation, but recognizing our politics in this country, primarily because of the problem with campaign finance, has extreme limits placed on it.
Right. Yeah. I agree with you on the campaign. The failure to get campaign finance reform is at the heart of the reason why it is so difficult to get good legislation through the Congress and also through many state legislatures. So
yeah.
I'll hop off and let someone else get on. Thanks,
Blair, thanks for calling, and thanks for your contribution to this
yep.
talk here. And thanks for getting us back on the air. You helped.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Hi, WPKN, you're on the air.
Oh, good evening.
Good evening.
Yeah, what I'm thinking, Scott, and he made a very good point about wasting political capital on this. You know, maybe he should have gone for a jobs program first. But what I'm thinking, this all gets back again to the real need for election reform, campaign financing, or if you're going to do what Bloomberg did, whatever the office pays, and if you want to pay out of your own pocket, you know, for your financing, all right, but as soon as it goes over the amount of money that the office pays, there should be like a dollar-for-dollar tax on what you finance. I mean, $100 million a man spent out of his own pocket. And the other big hurdle, you can't get on to be elected. You know, the parties, like here in New York, it's very easy to get on to the ticket. But if you're an independent, you have to go through extra hurdles to make it to, you know, the attempt to be on the election roll, if you follow what I mean.
Yeah, no, it's an extremely important issue, and it's the Rosetta Stone for most of what's wrong with our politics in this country.
Right, and I'm thinking, you know, all the things that are important, I think before we can, like, you know, build a second floor of the house, we have to have a really good basement, you know?
Yeah. No,
that's
true.
The election reform. The SEC allegedly, the airways are ours. Now, cable, that might be another animal, but the airways are allegedly ours. So they should grant free time to people that are running for office. You know, that would obviate these paid commercials.
Yeah, well, that's probably one of the most expensive parts of running a political campaign is television ads. And certainly, if you're in a big state, that's the only way you're really going to succeed. And the airtime is so expensive that that's what drives these guys to, in many cases, prostitute themselves out to the higher bidder, the highest bidder. And that's a sad commentary. But you're
well,
right.
That's what I'm saying. That's why we have to get away from that. You know, campaign financing. If you're going to use your own money and you go over a certain threshold, and it should be like a dollar for dollar tax. If Bloomberg wanted to spend $100 million, then he should pony up $100 million tax for the $100 million he spent.
That's an interesting concept. That's an interesting concept. Maybe we'll have to get out there and sort of campaign on it. That'd be wild.
Yes, but you have to, what do you call it, get your 501s or whatever the heck they call them in line.
Yeah.
This season.
Well, thanks so much for your call. I've got...
All right, I'll get off. Back to your show.
Yeah, appreciate it. And just one other thing on that topic. You think that if we did have campaign finance reform, it would be a lot easier for our legislators to blaze an independent path on a lot of issues and wouldn't be so beholden to these guys.
And what do you call it? Getting on the ballot. Ballot reform and campaign financing.
Yeah.
Again,
it's true. So
you
for
can't
some
get on the ballot, you know, if you're going to a recognized party, it's easy. But if you're an independent, you have to go through extra hurdles.
Yeah, instant runoff voting or proportional representation, as they have in most other parliamentary systems in Europe. That's the key, really, to getting much more representation of people who really lose in this winner-take-all system. And I don't know, but thank you for your call.
All right, thank you for letting me speak.
Ciao. Okay, bye-bye. And I think that's all we have time for. We've got a number of callers that came in, and not everybody got on the air, but thank you so much, and apologies for us popping off the air, as it's called. Don't know what happened there. Again, maybe the insurance companies weren't very happy with our discussion. Don't know. That's a little bit of paranoia there, sticking your pipe. But it's a couple of minutes before 9 p.m., and I think what we'll do is take a brief listen to part of that short documentary film produced by Donna Smith. Again, it's called American Sickos, and it takes stock of the people who are profiled in Michael Moore's movie Sicko, the documentary film Sicko, and takes really the pulse, excuse the pun, on where these folks would be if the health care reform legislation now being discussed and as we saw passed in the House of Representatives on Saturday night, if that were to go into effect, would it really help any of these people who had disastrous results on contracting one of many diseases that bankrupted them and really stressed them out and created havoc for themselves and their families? So let's take a quick listen to at least a little part of that film, American Sickos, as we leave this topic. This is WPKM in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM and WPKM in Montauk at 88.7 FM. And here's a little bit of American Sickos.
Hey, this is Donna Smith coming to you from my office in Washington, D.C. We're going to present you a little markup of the health care legislation provided to you by the American Sickos, the people who with me appeared as subjects of Michael Moore's documentary film, Sicko, about the U.S. health care system. We had some pretty terrible things happen to us at the hands of the health care system, and we've been watching with great interest as this whole health care discussion has unfolded in the nation and want to know if the legislation and what President Obama is proposing would prevent those things from happening to us again. And we're sad to say, to a person, the answer is all of the things that happened to us would still be able to happen. Tracy Pierce of Kansas City lost his battle with cancer, but he really lost his battle through the delays and the denials of his insurance company. The last months of his life, they fought an insurance company that denied right up to the end even some of his pain-killing medication. Is there anything in the legislation right now that would prevent that from happening in the future? The answer is no. How about little 2-year-old Michelle Keys? In the movie, her mother Donnell told us a story about how she raced her little infant daughter to the emergency room, and only to find out it was out of network.
It just didn't seem real.
She couldn't get her daughter treated there. Little Michelle had a cardiac arrest and died. 2 years old. Anything in the current legislation that prevents that? The answer is no. How about Reggie Cervantes, 9/11 worker?
I'm the 9/11 responder in Sitco. I had the emotional meltdown outside the pharmacy in Havana, Cuba, because the inhalers were 5 cents there and hundreds of dollars here. I needed them. I'm still struggling. Our health care system is broken, totally broken. The current proposed legislation is only set to put money into the pockets of the CEOs and back into the insurance companies.
We're driving across the Detroit River.
Adrienne Campbell, young woman from Michigan, who slipped across the border into Canada to get care with her little daughter, Aurora. Adrienne was a cancer patient. She had a surgery done that her insurance company would later on, in the great bait and switch that insurance companies are allowed to do, decided that the surgery she was given was routinely given to women over 26 years of age, and therefore they weren't going to pay for it. Anything in the legislation right now prevent an insurance company from making that decision? The answer is no. How about myself and my husband, Larry?
That was Donna Smith with her short documentary film, American Sickos, profiling what would happen under some of the current reform legislation to the individuals profiled in Michael Moore's movie Sicko, whose lives were turned upside down by their illnesses and bankruptcies that resulted from bad or non-existent health care coverage. But right now we're going to move to a different topic after I remind you that you're listening to WPKN in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM and WPKM in Montauk at 88.7 FM. And this show is Counterpoint. My name is Scott Harris, and we continue on until 10 o'clock tonight. Right now I want to introduce to you Carl Frisch, a senior fellow with the group Media Matters for America. Carl has worked with a Democrat, Howard Dean, in his 2004 presidential campaign bid, and in other capacities on Capitol Hill for both Democrats and, interestingly, for Republican John McCain during his 2000 campaign. Carl, thanks so much for being here tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Last Tuesday's elections saw two Democrats go down to defeat in statewide races for governor in both New Jersey and Virginia, as all of our listeners know by now. And Democrats picked up two additional House seats in special elections in both California and a longtime Republican stronghold in northern New York State. I don't think that seat had gone to a Democrat since the Civil War. But the media has, I think, by and large, spun the results of these elections as a victory for Republicans and a defeat and a warning sign for Democrats.
Right.
And, you know, that's widely, I think, the perception of anybody who was watching TV or reading newspapers, listening to the radio over the last week or so. But tell us your take on how this happened, why this happened, and the truth or myth of it.
Well, the one thing that is certainly true about the elections is that we learned that right-wing media figures and right-wing media outlets just ain't that good when it comes to election analysis. Back in 2001, in George W. Bush's first off-year election, when Democrats won the mayorship in Los Angeles and that had been Republican for 8 years, and the governorship in New Jersey, which had been Republican for 8 years, and the governorship of Virginia, which had been Republican for several terms, Republicans, including the White House and various media figures, most notably at Fox News, people like Dick Morris and Morton Kondracki and others, Laura Ingraham, all said, you know, these are local races decided on local issues. They're not really things, they don't have an impact on the presidency or Bush, et cetera, et cetera. And now, almost 10 years later, in the first off-year election of President Obama's administration, they're spinning it quite differently. You were right, perhaps understated when you said it had been quite a while since that House seat up in New York had gone Democratic. I believe there were actually Whig Party members that have represented that district more recently than a Democrat. But what's more interesting, taking for a moment and putting aside the Fox News talk radio spin that this was all about Obama, it would eventually lead to the failure of his health care plans with no public option, which would, of course, be proven wrong not even a week later. Exit polling indicated in the races that Barack Obama, people were not voting for or against him when it came to these races. What's interesting to note is that Christie in New Jersey and McDonnell in Virginia rarely spoke about Obama, never really attacked him in any way, and tried to run a centrist bipartisanship message. Notably in Virginia, McDonnell, a very, very conservative man who has close ties to Pat Robertson, shed that image and ran down the middle for the bulk of the campaign, trying to portray himself as a moderate and didn't really attack Obama. So those are two state races where the candidates didn't campaign against Obama, and exit polls by large majorities showed that people were not voting in any way about Obama. What about the races where people were campaigning against or for Obama's plans? The Democrats picked up that congressional seat out in California, which had been Alan Tauscher's for several years. So that was, you know, getting one more vote in there. But in New York, like you said, that seat that hadn't been held by a Democrat in nearly 150 years, the Democratic candidate, Bill Owens, campaigned in support, at least for the last week, of health care reform with a public option. And the Republican candidate ran a Glenn Beck-style campaign, the Conservative Party candidate ran a Glenn Beck-style campaign against everything Obama stood for, against health care with a public option, against any kind of government spending, and he was defeated. And it really exposed fissures within the Republican Party. And those are the two races, really, that have any impact on what's happening in Washington. And there were several people on Fox that said this was the end of, you know, Obamacare, there would be no public option, et cetera. And yet, Bill Owens, in his first major vote in Congress, was able to vote for health care reform with a public option.
Well, you know, I think in all this, it's certainly true that Barack Obama is not as popular as he was on his inauguration day, because there are all sorts of issues have come up, a lot of controversy,
sure,
a lot of spinning on the media against his agenda, a lot of disappointment by many progressives about where he's going with that agenda.
Which very few people ever talk about, by the way, when they talk about his decrease in polls. I think everybody would be willing to admit, including media analysts, that most presidents don't keep their popularity as high as when they're inaugurated months after the fact. But what you don't hear when they're talking about his dip in polls, keep in mind he's still, you know, wildly popular in every region of the country except for the South, according to polls, 60% in most regions of the country except for the South. What people don't talk about is progressive angst in polls when it comes to legislation.
Right, and we were just talking about a lot of the disappointment among many of our listeners tonight about the course of national health care reform with what came out of the House on Saturday night. But, of course, that's not the usual discussion.
Right.
But I wanted to get to this. Given that Barack Obama is certainly less popular than he was on Inauguration Day, and the spin of this election, these election results, really slanted towards creating this mythology that this was a referendum on his presidency and the Democrats are in big trouble for the 2010 midterm elections. How much of a self-fulfilling slant is that? And how much does this biased news coverage really influence public opinion? I mean,
a lot of the coverage, I don't know if it's biased or not. Bias involves a certain amount of mind reading. Obviously, Fox News has a very distinct point of view. But conventional wisdom making really has little to do with bias and more to do with people in the media not wanting to say anything that doesn't fit within a tiny little box. They like to fill up 24 hours a day, 7 days a week of wall-to-wall coverage with the same thing every 5 minutes. But in terms of this fantasy world, I think that right-wing conservatives who get their news from Fox and talk radio, they're going to believe this, and nobody's going to sway their opinion one way or the other. I can tell you, though, that if you look historically, and this has been covered some in the media, if you look at, and Bill Clinton has said this is probably going to happen, when and if Obama signs health care reform, regardless of really all the details being solidified, he'll likely get a boost. People like to see action, and there hasn't been much of that on any issues that the American people, you know, heard about a lot during the campaign, aside from various economic stimulus measures and stuff like that. So as these other issues start to get tackled, health care, global warming, you know, reforming Wall Street, I think you'll see his numbers go up. But you're right, there is a certain element here of how the media covers things. And at Media Matters, we always tell people it doesn't really matter what issues are important to you, so long as the media is covering them in a bad way. So I think it's important, keeping in mind that you and I are much more voracious news consumers than the average American. You know, you probably are like me when you see elections being covered and you're a couple weeks out from the election and there's still a chunk of people who are undecided, and it's kind of like, what's it going to take for you to make up your mind? But that's by and large the American people. They don't follow things too closely. And that's why there's a certain segment of the country that's politics and their opinions on issues and legislation is very malleable. And that's why you see healthcare popularity rise and fall and rise and fall from week to week. But I think there won't be any self-fulfilling prophecy here, because it was, I think, nipped in the bud with the passage of the health care bill in the House, regardless of any problems that progressives or conservatives might have with various aspects of it. You know, there also wasn't that much longevity to the spin that was coming out of the elections on Tuesday. If nationalized races had gone to Republicans, we'd be talking about a different story. But the races that went to Republicans are back to what they would normally be focusing on, setting up their governments in New Jersey and in Virginia to focus on issues important in Virginia and New Jersey. Whereas the two nationalized races sent people to Washington, and they voted in favor of health care. So there really isn't something that would provide the longevity necessary to keep the notion that Republicans have somehow turned a page in the national dialogue. You might see some of that in local state press. And, you know, in New Jersey and in Virginia, there's an element of truth to that, that there, it is newsworthy that Republicans have turned the page there or gotten back in power, so obviously that's going to be newsy. But on a national level, you've even seen it died down in the days following the election. So I don't think that's going to keep going. But what you're likely going to see with the return of focus to the national stage is what issues they're talking about, which is health care. So we're likely to see a great deal of coverage that is entirely misleading as it relates to health care reform efforts that are now going to the Senate.
And Carl Frisch is our guest here on WPKN and Counterpoint. Carl Frisch is senior fellow with the group Media Matters for America. Carl, I want to ask you this. It seems that in New York's 23rd congressional district, where the Democrat won, as we've been talking about, for the first time since the Civil War or thereabouts, that the Republican Party's Civil War maybe have already been decided in favor of the extreme right-wing fringe of the party, with Sarah Palin, Michelle Bachmann, Rush Limbaugh, and Glenn Beck calling the shots in the agenda for the Republican Party.
That's true. And you'll also notice that since the election, well, first of all, it's important to note that the media is paying attention to this fissure within the party, and conservatives have kind of staked out a ground, saying this is like a moral victory and that they're going to use it to move forward. Meanwhile, you see Democratic pundits on TV saying, please do go after this. Please do primary your mainstream conservative candidates or your moderate candidates with far-right teabagger fringe conservatives. And it looks like they're going in that direction. You've got very big primary challenges in Florida in the Senate race, Christie versus Rubio. You've got significant primary challenges now going on in New Hampshire, where a former right-wing gubernatorial candidate is challenging the National Republican Senatorial Campaign Committee's chosen candidate. You've got the same thing happening in states throughout the country in House races and Senate races. So you're likely going to see history repeat itself, even if the history is only, you know, just shy of a week old. And, you know, parties over long periods of time, and we don't all necessarily have the memory, shrink and grow and shrink and grow. But every so often, fissures develop in a party that creates real lasting change within that party. And as the Republican brand, if you look at any polls that have been reported of late, even though Obama's popularity has dropped some, and this is why I think it's important for the press to talk about the progressive aspect of that, the Republican Party brand has not increased in popularity, which would make, you know, just as a news observer, one question why Obama is less popular, yet Republicans are even still less popular than they were before. It might lead the questioning reporter, the one searching for truth, to the conclusion that perhaps progressives are not entirely happy with their president.
Carl Frisch, when you see some of the attacks on health care and a whole range of issues being pushed by the Democrats in Congress and Barack Obama from the White House, there seems to be just a flood of mistruths and deliberate lies that are coming out of the mouths of these legislators and party apparatchiks from the GOP side. And how good a job is the U.S. press doing in speaking or in analyzing what is being said and being truth detectors for the public? Because it seems like there is so much in the way of misinformation coming out of the Republicans that that appears to me not to be challenged by the mainstream media. Very dangerous notions in terms of the, you know, healthcare reform being like Nazi Germany or the Holocaust or Stalin in Russia. It's just over the top. It doesn't seem to be called all that often by the mainstream media.
No, and what we found is, you know, yes, I like to look at these things on a case-by-case basis. Because it's very hard to say, you know, CNN does a great job when I can riddle off example after example of CNN's problematic coverage as well as some of their better coverage. The same thing goes for MSNBC or ABC News or CBS. The one thing I can tell you carte blanche is that Fox News, which if anybody didn't realize it by now, Fox News is a partisan political apparatus. Fox News will continue to push lies as news. And I'm not just talking about the opinion programming on the station, which they like to liken as their op-ed page. I'm talking about the regular news portions of their network as well, which they try to distinguish, at least in talking points, when talking about their own network. You know, case in point, the whole death panel smear that originated from conservative politicians and made its way onto Fox over and over and over again. The rest of the mainstream press did debunk that in the first, you know, week to 10 days more than 40 times. The problem lies in taking the bait. Like I said, most people are not news consumers like you or I, where we're voraciously watching the news and reading papers and reading online websites and listening to the radio. Most people get their news piecemeal. So by the simple fact that outlets like CNN and ABC and MSNBC and others debunking this more than 40 times, they're reinforcing the idea that there could be death panels. What they should be doing is, yes, debunking this claim, pointing out who the people are behind it, but more importantly is resetting where the debate should be. And, you know, perhaps if you look at the death panel smear, it would have been appropriate for these outlets that were debunking that smear to then reset the debate and say, but if we want to talk about death panels, let's take a look at health insurance providers and how they regularly do what could be considered a death panel by denying claims or canceling insurance or investigating their own patients for mistakes on their applications for insurance, or denying because of pre-existing conditions. Those are real death panels, and too often you don't see the media putting these smears in the larger context.
And it could be that the health insurance has some influence on what the media covers and what it doesn't. When we look at the millions, hundreds of millions of dollars that go to the big networks on TV, cable TV, and the like from these insurance companies. But of course,
well, when you just a good example of that on global warming, Newsweek is sponsoring this big dinner, co-sponsoring, I should say, because they're co-sponsoring it with the big oil industries for reporters and folks to meet energy experts and politicians. Meanwhile, the magazine is allowing George Will, the largest circulated conservative columnist in the country, to again write a column. You know, he's been critiqued over the last year for writing these global science, global climate change, science denial columns, and now he's got one in Newsweek. So there's a good example of that.
Carl, I wanted to ask you more on the Republican move to the right, the extreme right. And you used to work for Senator John McCain back in 2000. I don't bring that up to embarrass you, but hey,
everybody experiments when they're younger.
Yeah, no, but it's interesting to have you on to talk about that because John McCain, you know, for all his mixed bag of political views and his image as a maverick in the party until I think last year, he certainly parted ways with the religious right and on a series of issues and. Actually, you know, called Jerry Falwell and his allies agents of intolerance during the 2000 campaign.
Before
you were working
going
with
and speaking
him.
At his university in 2008.
Yeah.
So, you know, the thing I've come to understand about John McCain that I may not have seen when I was 21, I think, at the time, and very delusional about my politics. All you have to do to understand John McCain is look at his voting record. The maverick image is something that has been entirely created by the media. And the disdain that right-wing evangelical Christian Republicans have for John McCain has nothing to do with his voting record. It has everything to do with one issue, and that is campaign finance reform. They saw that early on as an attack on their funding sources and their ability to engage politically. That is the only reason, fundamentally, that they have a problem with John McCain. His voting record on gay rights and on the abortion issue and on social conservative issue after social conservative issue lines up perfectly with the right, and it always has. It really comes down to that one issue of reform, and they consider that a shot across the bow, and they've never forgiven him for it. All of the quote-unquote maverick positions that John McCain takes really don't require that much guts at all. They happen to be issues that are wildly popular with the American people. You look at his attacks on the tobacco industry. You look at his attacks on, you know, money in politics. And all of the other ways that he stepped out to kind of differentiate himself from the average Republican. There are only a few examples, and they're all wildly popular with the American people. Maybe not with base conservatives, but wildly popular with the American people. And only one of those issues... Because keep in mind, the other issues like tobacco and a few others were supported by a lot of conservatives as well because they were just so popular. But any time John McCain attaches himself to something that Democrats support, it isn't just bipartisan, it's John McCain being bipartisan. Even if there are other Republican senators on the same side as him. It's never Olympia Snow is the biggest maverick in the Senate, even though she's got a much more maverick voting record than he does. And any time a Democrat crosses the aisle to vote Republican, they're not, or vote with the Republicans, they're not considered mavericks. People forget that Russ Feingold was the co-sponsor of campaign finance reform, and he has certainly not been treated the same way by the media as John McCain.
Well, I only mentioned McCain, really, and it's good to get what you've said here in terms of assessing, really, this maverick image that seems pretty artificial. But, Carl, you know, when you look at John McCain and his attitude towards the religious right, at least in a few key statements, he embraced them during his 2008 bid
That's
for the
true,
White House.
That's true, and I was happy with that, even though I didn't tell my coworkers.
Yeah.
But, you know, like I said, by 2008... McCain was being John McCain, and he was upfront and honest, and he reversed himself on all of those issues, from Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson to coming out much more ardently anti-gay, all of the above. He went back to his roots and stopped being the maverick, the supposed maverick that folks thought he was. You know, and in 2000 he was trying to have it both ways. He thought that these people were agents of intolerance, but he voted exactly how they wanted him to.
Mm-hmm. Well, Carl, I wanted to ask you about another topic entirely here, and that goes back to our early discussion of the spin. It goes to the earlier spin of the elections last Tuesday, mm-hmm. with a lot of the media talking about rightly or wrongly, Republican victories that will make a big difference in the future for the Democrats in this past election. There's a lot of advice, many pundits coming out talking about how Obama and the Democrats better move to the right here, lest they lose a lot of the independent voters that are crucial in the 2010 midterm elections. You know, the conventional wisdom, it seems, here in 2009 and going back many years, is that the Democrats always have to move to the right, and Republicans are rarely questioned about them moving further to the right. Which creates a really kind of disastrous and dangerous situation, I believe, in the country for having any kind of logical dialogue here on politics and where it's headed.
Well, all it would take is for one smart reporter to look at what's happened in the Democratic Party over the last decade. Howard Dean excited a lot of people, not just because he was against George Bush and the war, but because he said Democrats need to stand up and be Democrats again. And what's happened in the 5 years since Howard Dean came on the stage and really revolutionized the party? He became chairman, he changed the party, the candidates became more progressive, and they won the House in 2006 and the Senate in 2006. They gained more House seats in 2008 and more Senate seats in 2008. They gained state legislatures and governorships in both elections, and they won the White House by the largest margin in years in 2008. It's interesting to hear members of the media say that Obama and the Democrats in Congress are too liberal, especially when you consider that they're triangulating with only two sides of the triangle. If you look at health care reform, and I'm not advocating a position here, but if you look at health care reform, the progressive position is single payer. But rather than have a discussion about single payer, Obama came out in favor of a public option. And the media took that as the liberal point of view, even though the liberal point of view was single payer. So it became a discussion of public option versus no reform, and the only way to compromise was to move to the right. The same thing is true for fighting global warming. One could argue that the progressive point of view on global warming would be some kind of a carbon tax, and that the original, conservatives advocated cap and trade back in the day. So Obama taking that centrist role on cap and trade with no discussion about a carbon tax, again, it puts Obama and the Democrats in the position of having to move right from a centrist point of view. And we see this on issue after issue after issue. So my question for reporters is, if Obama was starting from a liberal point of view, it'd be one thing. But isn't he starting from a centrist point of view on all these big issues and moving to the right? In which case, shouldn't the right be moving to the left?
Yeah, and those are the kinds of discussions you rarely hear in the media. And Carl Frisch, when you look at the White House recent attack on Fox News, or just not even an attack
Let's
so much.
Let's be clear, they were responding to months of attacks.
Yeah. It wasn't even an attack. It was just stating the obvious, the
right way
I look at it, that there's an extreme right-wing and Republican agenda driving
what's... Of
course,
the media circled the wagons and said it was the White House's war on Fox. I'm like, where have you been for the war on the White House or Barack Obama personally?
But when you hear a lot of pundits criticizing the White House for picking a fight with Fox, regardless of where that fight emanated... Many of these pundits will say, well, the White House shouldn't engage in that fight. They shouldn't have taken the bait. It only raises the visibility and credibility of Fox News. I was happy that the White House actually was calling it like it was. These guys obviously have a right-wing agenda, and they should be called on it. But
you don't really hear members of the press saying that it gives Fox News more power, because they, fundamentally, they see attacks on Fox News as an attack on the institution of journalism. It's interesting, though, because rarely do you see a leading Democrat come out and attack Fox News, while still in office, at least. But that has been a staple of the strategy behind the right for more than 40 years. They will bend over backwards to appease people on the right. They would never accuse people on the right of, somehow making some faux pas for attacking the press, because they always do it. So I think part of it is that. The other part is they may look at Fox and think, well, if we don't stand up, they might come and attack us. But it's interesting, because if you were ever to accuse a reporter for like ABC News or MSNBC of doing something like Fox, they would consider that an insult. But when you actually call Fox what it is, which is a partisan political operation, the communications arm of the Republican Party and the conservative movement, suddenly they get testy. It's very interesting.
Well, Carl, how would you characterize the role of the media here in this period as we come up to the first year of the Obama presidency and the Democrats moving an agenda for the first time in a while forward on health care and a range of other issues? How fair has the media been in terms of how they're treating Obama and the Democrats?
They are certainly more interested in holding the Obama administration and Congress accountable and writing stories that are deeper looking than they were during the Bush administration. But we've noticed that happens to be cyclical. They were much more interested in Clinton and any possible scandal they could get their hands on than they were on anything of substance with the Bush administration until well into his administration, towards the middle of his second term. Again, I hate to characterize the entire media, but on a case-by-case basis, I would say that the coverage would probably get like a C-, simply because they focus on pointless drama. They do not delve deep enough into issues, explaining to people. When polls show that the American people do not understand what this reform or that reform means, it is not just the politicians communicating what the reforms mean that are creating this problem. It's the media that these politicians have to communicate through. And I'm not saying that the media should just give somebody an open mic, but rather than doing week after week after week of one Republican and one Democrat fighting about some issue point or some perceived scandal, perhaps they could do some real reporting on what the legislation is calling for and what that would mean for the average person, and what the other side is proposing and what that would mean for the average person. I bet you fewer people know that the Republican plan for health care reform would only insure about 3 million people out of the 45 million people that are uninsured right now, that it would actually only decrease the deficit by about $200 million as opposed to the Democratic plan, which would do it by billions of dollars, and that they do not do anything about pre-existing conditions or people being shoved off of health care when they get too expensive. These are things that people don't know because the press is more interested in talking about the tit-for-tat of politics than they are about the ins and outs of policy.
And, Carl, just lastly, if you were to give one piece of advice to our listeners about how they can play a role in holding the corporate media accountable to be more aggressive on the issues that matter, get more information out that counts for people in forming their political opinions, what could we do as news consumers here to make that happen?
Well, the first thing I would do is go to MediaMatters.org every single day and log on. We are updated throughout the day, 7 days a week, where we are providing you with the research and information you need to combat what you're seeing in the media. But the second thing is, whatever issue is important to you, begin to care about how the media covers it. And when you see a problem, respond and take action. Literally, a few well-thought-out emails to a reporter or an editor or a producer or a TV show can have an impact, especially when you're armed with the right research. We've seen changes in behavior in cable news, broadcast news, and newspapers based on just a few well-thought-out emails from people that are concerned. So visit MediaMatters.org every day and arm yourself with the facts so that you can go out there and be an activist when it comes to news consuming.
All right, Carl, thanks so much for sharing your thoughts on a lot of these important issues tonight with us. And it's MediaMatters.org, right?
That's it.
All right, Carl, take care. I hope we can talk again soon.
Sounds great.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Carl Frisch, a senior fellow with the group Media Matters for America. That's MediaMatters.org on the Internet. The internets. Anyway, it's 25 minutes before 10 o'clock. This is WPKM in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM and WPKM in Montauk at 88.7 FM. You can find us on the web at WPKN.org, where you can find out more about our programs, find some audio archives, as well as make a secure online contribution. We'll be back with a look at some of the local election races here in Connecticut in just a minute with Joe Dinkins of the Working Families Party of Connecticut. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. From Jackson Browne, Information Wars. This is WPKN in Bridgeport, WPKN in Montauk. My name is Scott Harris. The program is Counterpoint. Glad you're listening tonight. And don't forget to support this listener-sponsored radio station. We need your participation to survive. And that's no joke. You can make a secure online contribution at WPKN.org or call us anytime at 203-331-9756 and let us know you want to support us with a pledge. That can come anytime. Doesn't have to wait till we're on the air asking for your your donations. Right now, I want to welcome to the program Joe Dinkin. He is a communications director with the Working Families Party of Connecticut, here to do a postmortem of the local election races here in Connecticut. Joe, thanks for being here.
Sure. Thanks for having me again.
Yeah. Tell us a bit about the Working Families Party. There may be some who still don't know a lot about the party and how you guys work in terms of cross endorsements and the like.
Okay. Well, Working Families is an independent political party in Connecticut, founded by community organizations and labor unions and neighborhood activists who felt like the major parties weren't doing enough to stand up for ordinary citizens on issues like creating decent living wage jobs, not just low wage service sector, no benefits jobs, but creating decent jobs that actually can, give a family a reasonable standard of living, creating, expanding access to high-quality and affordable health care, allowing workers to take paid sick days when they need them to recover, keeping taxes more progressive, issues like that. And, we're a little bit different from a lot of third parties that, folks sometimes think of, like Ralph Nader's presidential runs, because what we do is a little bit different in a lot of races. We use a tool known as cross-endorsement. What that means is, our party, our members interview all the candidates, Democrats, Republicans, and independents, and, research on their backgrounds and, do really rigorous studies of who's running. And then we only endorse the ones who we think we can really count on to stand up for those values, regardless of party. Now, that means, in a lot of races, you can go into the ballot and see a candidate on the ballot twice, once, maybe as a Democrat, and again on the ballot on the Working Families Party line. And our supporters vote on the Working Families Party line, one, because it's a way to help elect a good candidate, but two, because it's also a way to send a message with your vote. We say it's, voting Working Families is voting your values, because it's a way to tell all politicians the issues that you really care about. Now, I'll say this year's election cycle, that was actually not the only thing we did. This year we also did a little bit of the more traditional third-party candidacies. Difference in this case from some other third parties is that in the places where we did that, we actually, did really well and we won.
I want to find out more about that. I think that had to do with some races up in Hartford.
Sure, yeah. We actually, we had a couple of kind of co-equal top priority races this year, but two of those were Board of Education races in Hartford and in Bridgeport. In each of those cities, Working Families Party ran and supported candidates for Board of Education, Working Families Party only candidates, and in each of Hartford and Bridgeport, we elected two Working Families Party candidates to the Board of Education. Nobody ever said that fixing the problems of urban education would be easy, but I'm certainly glad that some courageous activists like the folks who were just elected in Hartford and Bridgeport have stood up to say that they're willing to give it a try.
Yeah, well, I want to talk a little bit more about the issues in that and some other races that Working Families Party worked on this past Tuesday and certainly in the months leading up to it.
Sure.
But I want to mention one important race that related to an earlier discussion we had tonight on New York's 23rd Congressional District, where a historic breakthrough with a civil war in the Republican Party against the Republican nominee, Deidre Scosafaza. And Doug Hoffman, the conservative, was embraced by Sarah Palin and a lot of these other national right-wing activists. The conservative lost after Deidre Scosafaza endorsed the Democrat, Bill Owens. But your party, the Working Families Party, with its chapter in New York State, had cross-endorsed Bill Owens. So he was running on both the Democratic and Working Families Party line in New York's 23rd Congressional District for that important race. So actually, tell us, I didn't see it reported, but how many votes did Bill Owens get on the Working Families Party line there? Do you know?
I think that'd be a better question question for some of our
for somebody from New York.
I don't have that in front of me.
Well, just out of curiosity, but it certainly played a role, and I'm sure the victory
sure, yeah.
he had there.
And, you know, I think a lot of voters, especially independent voters who are frustrated with the way the economy is going, will look at the ballot and look for who the Working Families Party candidate is, because they know that that's a candidate who they can, you know, who they can count on to really advocate for kind of the issues that matter to them, kind of the pocketbook issues that really hit home.
Right. Well, Joe, I wanted to talk about some of the issues in the Board of Education races that you're talking about
sure.
in Hartford and Bridgeport. But before I do that, let's also just kind of give the overview of municipal races that took place all across the state of Connecticut
mm-hmm.
and some of the results, because I know there were some longtime incumbents that bit the dust here. And there's, you know, the idea that in rough economic times, incumbents often get into a lot of trouble. And that was true in Stamford and Trumbull and some other towns across the state. Why don't you give us the overview here of what happened to Democrats, Republicans, and your endorsed candidates?
Well, I think it's fair to say that incumbents and incumbent parties lost in a lot of towns in the state. In a lot of places that meant Democratic mayors losing to Republican challengers, or Republican. In a few towns, Republicans losing to Democrats, and in a few towns, Republicans holding on to seats in heavily Democratic towns, among them New Britain and Middletown. But I think the most interesting story are the places where there weren't kind of just two parties competing. There was also the Working Families Party, and the ones where we expended our most our biggest effort was in Hartford and Bridgeport.
And so you have a tally, really, of winners and losers in terms of Democrats, Republicans, and including your party, and overall
races?
Well,
we worked in a few other places where of course it wasn't all wins, and most election nights are kind of a mix of winning and losing. One of our biggest disappointments on election night was Tim O'Brien in New Britain. Working Families Party had cross endorsed Tim O'Brien for mayor, the Democratic candidate for mayor in New Britain. We'd worked really hard for him with our volunteers knocking on doors and making phone calls. We sent mail and pretty much gone all out. Tim O'Brien is I think bar none one of the best champions of the issues that Working Families Party is about, he is known as a champion around the state for being one of the leading advocates for reforming our regressive property tax system. He's been kind of out front on supporting bills to expand access to health care, things like that. So he was, really up our alley. We worked real hard for him, and he had a pretty close and disappointing loss.
Okay. And what were some of the big issues that you guys were dealing with, aside from, who's up or down, who won or lost, but what were some of the big issues in the cities and towns that you worked in?
Mm-hmm. Taxes? Do you want me to speak about Hartford and Bridgeport or in some of the other cities?
The ones that struck you that really had wide appeal this time around, again, was with the unemployment rate really high?
In Bridgeport. There were a few contested council races, but the kind of most interesting race on the ballot was the Board of Education race. I think there's one interesting thing about that is, our two candidates were both parents of Bridgeport public school kids, and, one of our candidates was an incumbent, but other than her, no other current member of the Bridgeport Board of Education currently had a child in the schools. And so we felt like people with a little skin in the game, candidates like ours, who are Sauda Baraka and Maria Pereira, would, really fight harder to stand up for our kids and to stand up for the parents. Obviously our urban school districts have a lot of troubles with sky high dropout rates, with low achievement, with schools that aren't don't necessarily feel like safe or healthy environments for our kids, and I think those those issues that our two candidates in Bridgeport were able to speak to as parents. They, you know, could speak very honestly and from the heart about how those issues are affecting our kids. I think that's what really pushed them over the top.
Now, before we run out of time, Joe, I wanted to just touch on an issue that's quite important to many of our listeners, and that's the direction of health care at the national level.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you and many other groups around the state are disappointed with Senator Joe Lieberman's stated plan to obstruct health care reform. And a lot of us are disappointed with the direction that it's going, given what came out of the House on Saturday. But yet, I don't think anybody wants to see Joe Lieberman prevent a vote on whatever comes out of the Senate.
Absolutely not.
With a filibuster.
Thing,
so.
It wasn't that long ago when Joe Lieberman was talking like a champion of health care. Back in 2006, when he was running for re-election, he would often say that he could do more to help bring about health care reform, to help bring about universal health care, than his opponent Ned Lamont could. And I think we're seeing those words in retrospect as a little bit of campaign rhetoric, but maybe not much else. He even, you know, went so far as to propose programs in his campaigning that, you know, not identical, but that sound kind of a lot like the public option that he's railing against today.
Now, I wanted to mention an event here, and I should have mentioned it earlier, but I will do so now. There's an Interfaith Fellowship for Universal Healthcare that's going to be taking place in Stamford this coming Sunday, November 15th at 6 p.m. It's going to take place at Stamford High School across the street from what I hear is Lieberman's house or his mother's house. I'm not quite sure the situation there, but you want to mention that? You may be aware of this.
Sure, yeah, I've heard of it. I know about as much as you do.
Okay. Well, I'll just read from it. It says, the Interfaith Fellowship for Universal Healthcare, a multiracial, multicultural group of religious leaders of diverse faith traditions from throughout Connecticut, has been a partner with the Healthcare for Everyone campaign in the passage of Connecticut's healthcare reform, SustaNet, landmark legislation that creates a state public option and addresses access, cost, and quality. We've talked about that on this program, and I know you guys are on board that one as well. But this Interfaith Prayer Vigil is really, I guess, a way for religious leaders to come together to dissuade Joe Lieberman with a little bit of prayers,
right,
to abandon his obstructionist role here that he plans or has stated that he wants to take in the
right.
Senate. But I don't know if you want to say anything else about what you feel is appropriate now in terms of if we're Connecticut residents.
I'd suggest people go about grassroots democracy the best way we all know how, which is to continue writing and calling his office. At the end of the day, the people he really represents are voters in Connecticut. That's who he's obligated to represent. And the more of us he hears from about how crucial a public option is and how crucial the project of really reforming our broken healthcare system is, the harder it will be to, allow himself to be an obstructionist.
And, of course, one of the big issues has been a thread all throughout tonight is the money that the big insurance companies give to candidates, and Lieberman is no exception.
Major insurers are incredibly powerful.
And I'm not sure how much money Lieberman gets from the healthcare industry, but I think it plays no small role in his decision-making around these issues that we're talking about tonight. Well, Joe, anything you want to leave our listeners with in terms of some information would be helpful, a phone number, website, so our listeners can find out more about the Working Families Party.
Well, our website is ct-workingfamilies.org, it's still being getting its post-election update right now. Full Working Families election results ought to be up within the next couple of days. But it's a good place to kind of learn about some of our issues and our strategy. And you can sign up to get more involved, too, and I hope you will.
All right.
And again, that's www.ct-workingfamilies.org.
All right, Joe. Well, I appreciate all the work you're doing for spending time with us tonight. And
no problem.
Well, next time we'll talk about your projects for the coming year.
Okay. I hope to. hope to be back again soon.
All right, thanks.
Okay,
Joe.
Bye, Scott.
Good night. Joe Dinkin, he's communications director of the Working Families Party of Connecticut. And I'm just trying to find out here before we sign off and make way for Democracy Now, which is coming up next. Any kind of dollar amount I can give you for how much funds from the health insurance industry Joe Lieberman has pulled down. And I'm not seeing it just yet, but give me a second here, and I might be able to find it. Well, no. I think we'll make that a focus of next week's program. We're here every Monday evening between 8 and 10 for Counterpoint. My name is Scott Harris, and we hope you'll join us again next week. As I said, Democracy Now! Is coming up next, and we do have Free Speech Radio News airing at 11 to 11:30 p.m. tonight, as it is every weeknight, moved some months ago from its previous 6 p.m. slot. And I just always leave you with this. When I have time, and I do have time tonight, if you have comments or questions about my show or anything here at WPKN, I'm going to give you some addresses and emails and the like. You can call the station at 203-331-9756, 203-331-9756. You can write us via the old-style snail mail at WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Our email address is betweenthelines. Well, I should say my email address. If you want to reach me, send it to betweenthelines@snet.net. I'm having a little trouble with that account these days, so give it a little time. If I don't get back to you, it's because somebody over at Yahoo really screwed it up, but that's another story. But that's an email just for me. The general station email box is wpkn@wpkn.org. And the website, again, is wpkn.org. So that's it for me tonight. Thank you all for listening. We're going to leave off with a little bit of music, a couple of minutes from our friend Tom Waits, who's I've got a great song here, Heart Attack and Vine, which probably many of you will recognize as we pull on out of here and make way for Amy Goodman and her crew at Democracy Now! Stay tuned. That's up next. We'll be back next week. Thanks for listening. WPKN in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM and WPKM in Montauk at 88.7 FM. Stay tuned next for Democracy Now!
From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Now it falls on the United States Senate to take the baton and bring this effort to the finish line on behalf of the American people. And I'm absolutely confident that they will.
220 to 215. With that vote, the House of Representatives passed its version of health care reform. President Obama calls it historic and courageous, but Ohio Democrat Dennis Kucinich voted against the bill. We'll find out why. And we'll get analysis from Jane Hampshire of Fire Dog Lake about what comes next. And also why 64 Democrats joined Republicans in passing an anti-choice amendment to the health care bill. Then Honduras is the deal between the coup president, Micheletti, and the ousted president, Zelaya, on or off. We'll get the latest from inside the Brazilian embassy, where President Zelaya has been holed up for weeks. And the war comes home. As investigators continue to look into the reasons behind Thursday's deadly shooting, we go to Fort Hood to speak with a soldier who's just back from Iraq. He's been diagnosed with PTSD. He was familiar with the alleged shooter, the Army psychiatrist who treated others with PTSD. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The nation's unemployment rate has reached 10.2%, the highest it's been in 26 years. The Labor Department announced Friday the economy lost 190,000 jobs last month. October marked the 22nd consecutive monthly decline in jobs. This is the longest losing streak on record, dating back 70 years. African-American workers remain hardest hit. The black unemployment rate is now 15.7% and significantly higher for black men. In all, more than one out of every six workers were unemployed or underemployed in October. Many economists are projecting the unemployment rate will continue to rise.
Obviously psychologically damaging, and I think it is likely to go up a little bit further, given that we're already at 10.2%, and the type of growth and the type of employment trends that we anticipate over the next few months. You know, it is quite possible that we might even test the post-war record high of 10.8% at some point early next year.
On Capitol Hill, the House of Representatives has narrowly passed its landmark health insurance reform bill by a vote of 220 to 215. Only one Republican supported the bill. President Obama praised the vote, called on the Senate to pass similar legislation.
Now it falls on the United States Senate to take the baton and bring this effort to the finish line on behalf of the American people. And I'm absolutely confident that they will. And I'm equally convinced that on the day that we gather here at the White House and I sign comprehensive health insurance reform legislation into law, they'll be able to join their House colleagues and say that this was their finest moment in public service. The moment we delivered change we promised to the American people and did something to leave this country stronger than we found it.
While supporters of President Obama celebrated the passage of the health care bill, the legislation also marks a victory for opponents of abortion rights. On Saturday, anti-abortion Democrats helped push through an amendment to prohibit anyone who receives government health insurance subsidies from enrolling in an insurance plan that covers abortion. In addition, abortions won't be covered under the proposed government insurance plan. The amendment has been described as the biggest victory in years for opponents of abortion rights. We'll have more on the health care bill after headlines. The McClatchy newspapers report President Obama is nearing a decision to send 34,000 additional U.S. troops to Afghanistan next year. Under the proposed plan, the first additional combat brigade would arrive in Afghanistan next March, with the other three following at roughly three-month intervals. On Sunday, Army Chief of Staff General George Casey said the troops are needed in Afghanistan.
I believe that we need to put additional forces into Afghanistan to give General McChrystal the ability to both dampen the successes of the Taliban while we train the Afghan security forces.
In other news from Afghanistan, a NATO airstrike on Friday reportedly killed seven members of the Afghan security forces. The incident marks one of the worst cases of friendly fire in the course of the eight-year war. Iraqi lawmakers have passed a long-stalled election law, paving the way for national elections in late January. The election law provides for an open candidate list, allowing voters to cast their ballot for an individual rather than a party. This is Iraqi blogger Raed Jarar.
this election law is important to Iraqis because it increases the transparency of the Iraqi election system. Now Iraqis will be able for the first time to know who they are voting for. So all the candidates' names must be public. And in addition to the domestic importance of the law, I think internationally it's important because it will not give those who want to prolong the occupation an excuse. Many people have been trying to use delaying the Iraqi elections as an excuse to prolong the U.S. occupation.
In Honduras, an American-mediated accord to end the four-month political crisis appears to be in shambles just a week after it was signed. On Friday, the ousted president, Manuel Zelaya, declared the deal was over. Meanwhile, Roberto Micheletti, the head of the coup government, said he would install a national unity government without the participation of Zelaya. Supporters of Zelaya accused the coup government of killing the power-sharing agreement.
We don't think the de facto government ever had good faith intentions, just the desire to prolong its stay despite the Honduran people's will.
We'll have more on Honduras later in the program. The Guardian newspaper reports the last formal negotiation before the climate summit in Copenhagen concluded in acrimony Friday, with developing countries threatening to walk out of the December conference unless rich countries commit themselves to greater cuts in greenhouse gas emissions. Meanwhile, hopes for a strong global deal that would pay poor nations to stop deforestation hit a new low Friday after negotiators released a draft proposal that many environmentalists say lacks teeth. Here in this country, the Supreme Court will hear arguments today in a pair of cases to decide whether it's unconstitutionally harsh to sentence juveniles to life without parole. There are more than 1,700 people in the United States who will spend the rest of their lives in prison for crimes committed as juveniles. Some were as young as 13 when they committed the crime. No other nation has even a single person serving such a sentence. The Senate has unanimously confirmed the nomination of Joseph Bizarczyk to serve as director of the Office of Surface Mining Reclamation and Enforcement, despite widespread opposition from environmental groups and critics of mountaintop coal removal. The group Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility said, quote, President Obama's choice to run the Office of Surface Mining signifies that campaign promises to end environmentally destructive coal mining practices such as mountaintop removal will be abandoned. A new report by the Center for Responsive Politics has found 237 members of Congress are millionaires. That's 44% of the body. California Republican Dara Lissa is the richest lawmaker, with a net worth estimated at just over $250 million. At least seven lawmakers have net worths greater than $100 million. In Japan, over 20,000 protesters gathered on the island of Okinawa Sunday to rally against a plan for the U.S. Marines to build another permanent base off the coast of Okinawa. The U.S. operates more than a dozen U.S. military bases all over the Japanese island, which has been described as an unsinkable aircraft carrier. President Obama will be visiting Japan later this week. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is in Washington today to meet with President Obama. The talks come amid floundering U.S. efforts to jumpstart stalled Middle East peace talks. And in the West Bank, Palestinian protesters Friday knocked down part of the Israeli separation wall that divides much of the region. The protesters said the action was done to commemorate the 20th anniversary of the falling of the Berlin Wall. Palestinians hung a banner on the wall reading, quote, "No matter how tall, all walls fall." Israeli troops responded by firing tear gas and skunk spray, a chemical concoction that smells of corpses and feces. And tens of thousands of people are gathering in Berlin today to celebrate the events of November 9, 1989, when the Berlin Wall fell.